Welcome to the December podcast for Neurosurgical Focus. This issue is on the topic of concussion, pathophysiology, and sequelae. In this podcast, topic editor Dr. Paul Ecklin of the Elliott Sports Medicine Clinic in Burlington, Ontario, Canada, speaks with Dr. Anthony Petraglia of the University of Rochester Medical Center in Rochester, New York. They discuss Dr. Petraglia and colleagues' article, An Overview of the Basic Science of Concussion and Subconcussion, Where We Are and Where We're Going. The article appears in this month's issue.
My name is Dr. Paul Ecklin. I practice at the Elliott Sports Medicine Clinic as a fellowship-trained sports medicine physician in Ontario, Canada. And today I'm going to interview Anthony Petraglia, who is a physician at the University of Rochester in the Department of Neurosurgery. His interests are in neurological sports medicine, for which he's completed a fellowship, and his interests in spine surgery and general neurosurgery are also a component of his work. Anthony, I'd like to just briefly welcome you to this podcast and congratulate you on your upcoming article, An Overview of the Basic Science of Concussion and Subconcussion, Where Are We and Where Are We Going? First question is, what prompted your interest throughout, it looks like through undergrad and also through medical school and graduate school, concerning sports medicine and neurological pathology?
Well, thank you for having me, Dr. Ecklin. Sports medicine has always been something that I've sort of been interested in. I mean, I've grown up through the years as a big sports enthusiast. I was a three-season athlete growing up, and certainly concussion and head injury and neurological injury in sports certainly wasn't a focus as I grew up in sports. And as I came through medicine and found myself merging, obviously, with neurosurgery as a career, it was a real nice marriage for me, and it allowed me to merge one of my passions in sports with what I practice every day. And in neurosurgery, we deal with head injury all the time, but I think we've seen a greater emphasis and focus on mild head injury as the years have gone by. And so this is an emerging field that I'm very happy to step into.
Well, it sounds very familiar. That seems the same path as myself. I mean, as an athlete growing up, and then one of the reasons I wanted to go into sports medicine or medicine was the sports medicine component of it besides the general medicine. And then as a team physician, the brain injuries became more and more evident, and it's an interesting path that we both took. The first question I have is, public awareness concerning the incidence and seriousness of brain injury increases, what are your thoughts concerning the current knowledge level among the medical and scientific community?
Well, that's a great question that comes often. I mean, we've certainly seen skyrocketing levels of public awareness over the last several years. One only has to really turn on the television, listen to the radio, or really pick up any newspaper to catch a glimpse of really what's become front and center in medicine and society today. I think, however, while the public has come to a better understanding of concussion and mild TBI, I think we as a medical community have come to learn that we really have quite a long way to go. We must remain focused on, like, educating our colleagues and anyone that really partakes in the care of athletes that may sustain head injuries. And concussion is a complex process. And just anecdotally, it seems at times to be kind of handled in very heterogeneous ways. And now this may be due to the varied medical backgrounds. However, I think the onus is on each one of us to really remain competent with the most recent concussion management guidelines. And likewise, as I think our understanding of this type of head injury continues to evolve at a rapid pace, we need to stay up to date on the emerging scientific literature.
That's an excellent answer. The second question I have is, what is the importance of understanding? Why do you think the importance is central that we understand the basic science of concussion before, as you've seen in the public realm, therapies and treatments and other types of cures are introduced to the public?
Right. Well, I mean, understanding the fundamental biological processes and mechanisms of disease pathogenesis is critical to preventing, diagnosing, and treating diseases and conditions that afflict millions of people. I think a sound foundation of the pathophysiology of concussion can allow us to successfully translate laboratory discoveries from the bench to the bedside or the lab to the patient. current treatments for concussion are purely symptomatic when you look at them, and they're often patterned off other similar disease processes. For instance, many of the medications that are used to treat headaches and post-concussion syndrome and prolonged post-concussion syndrome patients are really derived from the migraine literature. So possibly as we begin to learn more about the pathophysiology specific to concussion, we can develop more tailored treatment approaches. And at the same time, I mean, research across a continuum doesn't always proceed linearly. Quite often it's a bidirectional process. So it's important to remember that while the insights into biological mechanisms and disease processes can inform us and spur new clinical interventions, conversely, the observations about the nature and the progression of disease, you know, seeing these patients with concussion on the field in real time, made in the course of patient care and clinical research, really will end up stimulating new basic science investigations and insights. So it's a sort of a continuum, and that's why I think we need to be up to date on this sort of science.
What are your thoughts on the current literature concerning concussions that are not diagnosed clinically or, you know, now noted as subconcussive injuries versus the concussions, again, that are diagnosed secondary to the symptoms associated with them?
Very close to home and something I'm passionate about. I mean, I think clinical care of the athlete with concussion really, when you think of this, traditionally centered upon the recognition of signs and symptoms associated with a concussive event. Initially, when you think about it, the appropriate management is centered on symptom-free waiting period of physical and cognitive rest, right, to allow the athlete, you know, usually to return to play in a graded fashion. Well, research has now suggested that the head impacts, they commonly occur during contact sports in which visible signs, you know, no visible signs or symptoms of neurologic dysfunction may develop. And we're seeing emerging evidence in the literature from different realms of science and studies. Recent biophysics studies utilizing head helmet accelerometers that are indicating that the athletes at college, high school, and youth levels are sustaining a surprisingly high number of head impacts, ranging from several hundred to well over 1,000 during the course of a season. The associated cumulative impact burdens over the course of a career obviously are just as equally important. And we have clinical studies that are coming out that are identifying athletes with obviously no readily observable symptoms, but who exhibit functional impairment as measured on neuropsych testing or functional MRI imaging. And such sort of imaging findings have been corroborated on diffusion tensor imaging studies, as maybe we'll talk later, demonstrating axonal injury in asymptomatic athletes at the end of a season. We also have emerging necropsy data, so recent autopsy data that's shown that there's subsets of athletes in contact sports who don't have a history that we know of or identified concussions, but nonetheless have developed chronic neurologic degenerative, neurodegenerative pathology consistent with chronic traumatic encephalopathy or other neurodegenerative diseases along that spectrum. And then finally, we obviously have emerging and evolving laboratory science and evidence that's demonstrated, you know, significant axonal injury, blood-brain barrier permeability, and other sorts of ultrastructural damage, all in the absence of behavioral changes. So such data really is suggestive that subconcussive level impacts can lead to significant neurological alterations, particularly if they're repetitive. And so this concept of subconcussion is a significant emerging one that definitely requires thorough consideration for the potential role that it may play in accruing sufficient anatomical and or physiological damage in athletes such that these effects of these injuries are going to clinically express later in life.
That's a great explanation. Going back to, again, fundamentals for the clinician or for the medical practitioner at any level, could you just briefly look at the basic laws of physics, you know, that result in a concussion? I think they're really, really key.
Yeah, I mean, I'm certainly no physicist, just a dumb brain surgeon, but some of these basic laws of physics, maybe they don't describe necessarily what results in concussion per se, but certainly they highlight the factors in play in any sort of head impact. So we know that concussion involves the translation of kinetic energy and force vectors, either a linear acceleration-deceleration mechanism or through some sort of rotational mechanism or some combination of both force vectors. So if you just look at two basic physics concepts, provides an overview, an ultrastructure for this, it enables you to see how the force and head impacts result in head and then consequently brain acceleration. So Newton's second law of motion, and it's very basic physics law, is force is equal to mass times acceleration. So that helps to quantify linear forces. But then you have the rotational component, or torque, and that's calculated by the moment of inertia times angular acceleration. So when you're considering the overall laws in physics of conservation of energy, the sum of the kinetic energies of the struck athlete or struck patient and the striking object, they have to equal each other, and they have to equal the total linear and angular energy imparted to the head plus that energy dissipated from the head. So energy has to be transmitted somewhere, right? Energy in has to equal energy out. So we know that this is being transmitted to the head. And if you look at the kinetic energy, so again, getting back to basic physics, kinetic energy is 1/2 mass times velocity squared, so 1/2 mv squared, basic physics equation that we learned growing up in high school and on forward. But when you consider modern-day athletics, today's athletes are bigger and stronger, right? So there's increased mass. But more importantly, these athletes are also faster. The velocities at which they're hitting people and the velocities at which they're playing are much greater. So when that impact occurs, you basically look at that equation and the squaring of that velocity of impact in the kinetic energy equation, you can see that the resulting increase in kinetic energy and therefore imparted forces is actually quite profound. So that kind of provides a bit of a framework for understanding these forces.
Continuing from there, the recent explosion of helmet-based research, which is the closest to implant or getting as close to the brain or the skull as you can, I'd just like you to comment on what you feel the contribution is of this type of field-based real-time research, despite the fact, again, it's currently impossible to directly measure brain forces or forces imparted on the brain itself.
Sure. There's extreme variability between concussive impacts. There's obviously no two are going to occur at the same speed, with the same direction, containing the same mass, so you know, no two players are going to be the same weight, or exactly, you know, the same anatomical location or point of impact. So this obviously creates huge issues when you're trying to pin down what is it that's going to lead to a concussion. But while we may not be able to measure direct brain forces, developing obviously an understanding of the pieces of this puzzle, a better understanding of the biomechanical parameters that contribute to head injury may direct us in ways to better develop equipment or change certain aspects of the way some games are played to better protect our athletes. From a clinical standpoint, I think with time and further research, helmet-based accelerometers could provide another tool and function as an aid, an adjunct measure of assessment in concussion, but currently there's so much more to learn. Studies in the literature have shown tremendous variability between the thresholds for clinically diagnosed concussion in terms of linear acceleration, rotational acceleration, and location and number of impacts, and that's certainly been a source of frustration for some of these studies. But probably one of the most striking pieces of data, I think, in my opinion, that's come from this field of research has been regarding the sheer number of head impacts that the athletes in contact and collision sports sustain. Some of the biophysics data gathered through the football helmet accelerometer studies have shown that youth, high school, and college players, as I mentioned before, may experience a wide range of head impacts from several hundred to over 1,000 during the course of a single season. So compared to the location and the magnitude of forces, it may be more likely that the cumulative number of head impacts best correlates with the potential for concussion occurrence or chronic effects post-concussion. It's just uncertain right now if head impacts have a threshold for magnitude or number of hits or both, which could result in a cumulative risk for detrimental effects on brain structure or physiologic function, obviously.
No, I agree completely. I mean, that's what, when I was reading through those studies as well, it is that cumulative effect that nobody's seeing because they look okay. They don't show up at the clinic. They don't complain to anybody. But over the years of and seasons of playing contact collision sport, it looks like an avenue of exploration, especially when we start to image the injuries over time.
Absolutely.
So the next question is about if you could, again, summarize the current knowledge about primary and secondary injury of the brain after the trauma is sustained.
Sure. I mean, so primary injury is pretty straightforward. I mean, and it involves the transmission of energy and forces to the brain at the point, at the moment of initial impact, and then obviously all the associated damage that comes as a result. It's the secondary injury that's a bit more difficult to assess, obviously, at the human level in mild TBI. We've really relied on animal models of injury to derive much of this knowledge. Secondary injury is classically described as the indirect result of trauma and all the subsequent pathophysiologic processes that ensue. These processes can include both immediate as well as delayed cellular events. And while we don't usually detect nervous system injury on standard structural neuroimaging studies, we do know that there is ultrastructural damage that occurs. The forces imparted to the head are believed to result in shear stress to neurons and subsequent traumatic axonal disruption. We know there's neurofilament compaction and alterations of microtubules and that can cause focal swellings at the site and point of injury. And ultimately, these can interfere with axonal transport of proteins that are crucial for overall day-to-day function at a neurologic level. The shear can also cause subsequent dysregulation of protein channels within the neuronal plasma membrane, and that can result in an uncontrolled ion flux, neurotransmitter effects. And Giza and Hovda at UCLA did much of this classic work on these metabolic disturbances and ionic shifts, and this is all reviewed in the paper.
An additional component that I found very interesting in your article was the early research contributions of cerebral blood flow dynamics and blood-brain barrier and neuroinflammation components, which again shows the breadth of trauma that goes on and changes as a result of the trauma when these head injuries occur.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I mean, as you know, in the uninjured brain, cerebral blood flow is highly regulated with the ability to rapidly adjust perfusion levels to meet the brain's metabolic needs. We're all probably more familiar with the effect of moderate and severe traumatic brain injury on cerebral blood flow alterations. However, there's some laboratory and clinical data to also suggest that such cerebral blood flow alterations also exist in mild TBI, just like concussion. So as an example, they've done small angiographic studies in some young athletes where some investigators found a significant reduction in blood flow in concussed athletes compared to controls from early on, so in the early few days following a concussion, and lasting as far out as a month post-concussion. Now, this is interesting when you consider why athletes are symptomatic, right? I mean, does anyone really know why concussive athletes get the symptoms they do? Is there a significant blood flow-related effect? I don't know. Are concussed athletes not able to meet the brain's metabolic needs because of dysautoregulation? What role does the microcirculatory vasospasm play in symptoms and overall pathophysiology? I mean, these are all things that need to be further elucidated. And more so, are there translational treatments that can be targeted to improve blood flow dynamics or reduce microcirculatory vasospasm that ultimately might improve clinical care of the concussed athlete? So then when you regard the blood-brain barrier, obviously the events leading to blood-brain barrier breakdown are probably multiple in nature when you consider them all. The shearing forces of primary injury obviously are believed to damage the endothelium, and that can result in increased small vessel permeability and dysregulation. But there's other mechanisms, like we just talked about vasospasm and blood flow alterations, as we just discussed, or irregularities in nitric oxide secretion that may contribute early on after injury. As you start to get further out from the initial impetus of impact, things such as astrocyte dysfunction, inflammatory-mediated disturbances, or metabolic disturbances can further contribute to or prolong blood-brain barrier breakdown. Compromise of the blood-brain barrier breakdown has several consequences, including edema, excitotoxic cascades, so something to be considered in the scope of mild TBI. And finally, we're starting to learn more about the role of the neuroinflammatory system in mild traumatic brain injury. Microglia serve primarily and heavily in sort of a reparative phagocytic role in brain injury. And as microglia become activated, they're anti and pro-inflammatory cytokines, chemokines, trophic factors, free radicals, lipid peroxidation products, and excitatory molecules that are all released into the extraneuronal space. And so while microglia are usually the garbage men and they clean up these debris, they can sometimes release factors themselves becoming neurodestructive. And so doctors, you know, Joseph Maroon and Russell Blaylock, you know, they've speculated about the role of chronic microglial activation and subsequent neuroinflammation and immunoexcitotoxicity and what role that plays in the chronic neurological sequelae that we see after repetitive TBI. Now, these theories, they're really just theories, and they need to be explored further in future scientific works. But the role of our own innate neuroinflammatory system in concussion and repetitive mild TBI really does need to be further elucidated.
I mean, the advancement of those areas, those many areas right now, as we're talking in the year 2012, could really assist in at least treatments that could assist with individuals that you see, that I see with chronic symptoms, that whose lives are incredibly impaired by loss of stability and loss of a lot of times earn a living because their impairment secondary to brain injury.
Sure.
I was interested in the study of the rodent brain, mostly because of the accessibility, the inexpensive model for studying trauma. What are the current directions in human research, especially in the area of subconcussion, and as we mentioned, the secondary events that occur within a head trauma?
This is, again, a focus of my interest, my academic hobby. I'm particularly taking an interest to laboratory studies of repetitive brain injury and animal models and modeling some of the chronic neurological sequelae that we see and developing animal models of some of these chronic neurodegenerative syndromes that we're seeing. But I agree with you that obviously the accessibility and the inexpensive nature obviously sets a nice framework for studying those. But we do obviously need to look towards humans as well. This is, again, a very fluid continuum of research. And so much of the current clinical work in subconcussion has been borne out in some of the more advanced neuroimaging studies. So studies by Breedlove, Talavage at Purdue, they've demonstrated quantifiable neurophysiological changes in both functional MRI and impact testing in the absence of outwardly observable symptoms of concussion. They found that those asymptomatic players with functionally observed impairments were found to exhibit changes in functional MRI activation for working memory tasks that were at least as large as those occurring in players in which a concussion diagnosis was made in a symptomatic player by a team physician. And that's just phenomenal when you think about it. We're talking about asymptomatic players that are showing changes on advanced functional tasks. Now, there are other studies, too, that are utilizing diffusion tensor imaging to highlight the injuries that we're observing in subconcussion. There was a recent prospective cohort study they did in high school athletes. They found asymptomatic athletes with multiple subconcussive head blows had significant changes in the percentage of their white matter that was over three times higher than control patients. And in a study where they compared to control patients that didn't have any head impacts. Now, the significance of these white matter changes and their relationship to overall head impact forces is currently unknown, but nonetheless, it spawned subsequent ongoing research efforts from these researchers and hopefully others.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I mean, in our recent study, we saw very similar results to what you're currently talking about among those that were not diagnosed with concussion. So I think the advanced MRI and even some of the EEG or evoked potential studies are really looking at as much as we can without really implanting something within the brain tissue, which would be very difficult. But
yeah, it's a huge burgeoning area of research, and I think it opens up another whole framework in considering the types of, you know, head impacts that we're seeing in our athletes.
I don't think that the CDC, you know, language about being the silent epidemic is really too far off compared to what you and I experience on a daily basis.
Yeah.
This is a really good question to bring this to a bit of a conclusion. What place do you think public concussion education plays in the advancement of scientific knowledge and improved clinical care of this very serious brain injury?
There's certainly a paucity of medical evidence in concussion management. I mean, much of what we do is based off of expert opinion, consensus, observational studies. But of all the different aspects of concussion management, from diagnosis to return-to-play decisions to pharmacological treatments, the one thing that we do have good evidence for is concussion education. We know that those athletes that are properly educated about concussion fare better than those that aren't. Same goes for families. So the more we can raise public awareness and improve their knowledge base, the better sense we can get for the scope of the problem, the easier we can get athletes and families to buy into the seriousness of this injury and partake in their own care, and more importantly, allow for the most effective treatment we have right now, which is prevention. So undoubtedly, this is obviously too a bidirectional process that will also shape and affect the scientific progress we make. So, I mean, public concussion education across the board is priceless.
Yeah, I agree completely. I think the earlier the better. I think from my perspective, I think this is a generational change in that you want the societies that we live in to be active and to be fit, but you also want them to be informed, and we want to prevent disease states such as a concussion or minimize it and also educate. think the last question is that I really appreciate all your question and comment. I really appreciate all your time and your recent article that's coming out this month. Do you have any additional thoughts concerning this significant and emerging public health issue?
Without a doubt. I mean, recent years have been filled with major cultural and scientific shifts in the way athletes, coaches, parents, and physicians view sports-related neurological injuries, particularly concussions. The enormous public health impacts, partly due to the large scope of athletes susceptible to such injuries, from the world-class athlete to the weekend warrior and those partaking in youth sports. Most scientific studies probably up to this point have focused on more moderate and severe traumatic brain injury. But concussive and subconcussive head injuries affect more people, occur more frequently, and are a silent epidemic of increasing importance because younger patients suffer more mild TBI as a consequence of sports-related activities and military experience. In order to ultimately develop potential translational and preventative measures, it's clear that further research is going to be needed to have a more complete appreciation of the potential impact of concussion and the emerging concept of subconcussive brain injury on neurological function, both acutely and chronically. And then finally, I think concussion has seen involvement from all fields of medicine and sports medicine. For centuries, teams of people with multiple skill sets, experience levels, and technical competencies have consistently outperformed any individual trying to act alone, trying to solve a problem or complete a task. Similarly, I think, in my opinion, effective assessment and the management of concussion requires a coordinated, interdisciplinary approach with all team members seeking to collaboratively achieve common objectives, and that includes the athlete and the parents, friends, athletic trainers, teachers, and any and all sports medicine practitioners involved with their care. So paramount to the efficient and effective care of the athlete is a sound understanding by all practitioners and players of the pertinent issues relevant to neurological injury. And while this can be challenging, obviously, in an expansive and constantly evolving field like concussion, I think we can all work together to keep each other up to speed and to move this field forward.
The statement about concussion is everybody's responsibility, I think, fits well with that. And on behalf of both myself, the audience, and the Journal of Neurosurgery, I'd like to thank you again very much for your time today and your enlightening article, as well as this interview.
Thank you so much.
Science and all your knowledge concerning concussion.
Yes, thank you.
This concludes our podcast for the December issue of Neurosurgical Focus. Please join us for the January issue, when the topic will be The Science of Neurosurgical Practice. Thank you for listening. JNSPG podcast content is now contained in the newly launched American Association of Neurological Surgeons iTunes U site. Sign up in iTunes for our podcasts and additional content, including video content and podcasts from the AANS, all updated continuously. To read all the articles published by the Journal of Neurosurgery this week, or to listen to more podcasts, please visit us at www.thejns.org. You can also follow the Journal of Neurosurgery Publishing Group on Twitter, and now also on Facebook.